Monster Man, Episode 88, Death Dog to Death Knight.
Stop missing with the Monster Man, it was a bad plan, but I had to get to town on this.
Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming supplements of yesteryear, and as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In this season of Monster Man, I'm reading my way through the Fiend Folio supplement from TSR UK for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. It came out in 1981. In this episode, I'll be taking a look at the Death Dog and the Death Knight, two very different deathy monsters. But before we do that, I've got a lot of other things to talk about. Let's begin with a piece of reader mail. I got a great comment on G+ on my post about episode 87, in which I discussed the Dakin. And it was from Nick Parenti, who wrote an article in Dragon Magazine back in the day expanding the Dakin for use in Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. It's really interesting. I mean, it basically gives the Dakin, like I said, they're lawful and they're intelligent, and that really means that they're civilized. And it gives them a civilization and customs and different types of Dakins who fulfill different social structures. And it basically kind of, I mean, I don't want to say it makes them into Gorilla City from The Flash, but that's sort of the vibe that I got from it, right? This kind of ritualistic, orderly culture. Now, I mean, it's fascinating. I'm really glad that I read it. At the same time, it's kind of, I mean, it's created from the whole cloth, right? Like, it doesn't take anything from the first edition Dakin other than those basic things I just mentioned, because there just isn't anything else to take. It's kind of making bricks without straw. And while I really enjoyed it, and while, you know, if I ever have Dakins in my game, they'll be influenced by that version of them, I still don't know why they're shabby. So thank you very much, Nick, for bringing that to my attention. It was really fun to read. Secondly, voting is now open in the second Monster Man contest, or at least it should be. What I mean is it's not at the time that I am recording this, but by the time that you are hearing it, it should be. So there will be a link in the show notes to the voting page, or you can get there from the Monster Man community on G+, or our Patreon site, or my blog at gonzohistorygaming.blogspot.co.uk. So really, so many ways to vote. Go look at all the fun monsters that people have created based on a list of procedurally generated Dungeons & Dragons monster names. There's monsters up there with stats for Tunnels and Trolls, with stats for Fighting Fantasy, all kinds of things. It's been a lot of fun reading them, and I hope you enjoy them as well. And finally, I have kind of some unrelated news, which is that if you are a reader of the magazine of the bizarre and unexplained and just kind of generally weird 14 times, there is an article in this issue, which should be coming, it's the August cover dated issue for 2018, if you're listening to this episode later. That's issue 369, and it is by me, and it's about H.P. Lovecraft and archaeology, and sort of the role that archaeology and ancient history play in Lovecraft's fiction. And I'm really pleased that it is the cover article of this issue. So if you're a reader of 14 times, and you looked at the magazine, and you thought, huh, James Holloway, that guy has the same name as the guy from Monster Man. Nope, same person. So if you like history, and you like the Cthulhu mythos, you might check that out. I think you would probably enjoy it. All right, let's get going. First up, we have the Death Dog. This was submitted by Underworld Oracle, the writer who also created the Mirage. And the Death Dog is a big, mean, two-headed dog. And they are said to be the descendants of Cerberus, the dog who guards the underworld in Greek mythology. And I guess this makes sense, right? Cerberus has three heads. Normal dogs have one head. So by the principle of averages, I guess the idea is that if Cerberus mated with a regular old one-headed dog, the resulting children would have the average number of heads between them, two heads. So they're big, mean, two-headed dogs, and they can run at you and knock you down, and there's a special little knockdown rule in here. Basically, if they hit you on a 19 or 20, then there's a chance you could get knocked down. This is another example of a monster that contains basically a little mini-system. And there has been some debate about the advisability of this. If you think about the transition in, what was it, like the early 2000s, like 1999, 2000, 2001, whenever it was, that Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition came out, one of the things that was much touted about the system was that it would finally kind of unify and make consistent all the different disparate aspects of the AD&D mechanics. So if a giant bull tries to knock you down, or a rhinoceros tries to knock you down, or a death dog tries to knock you down, or a thug tries to knock you down with his shoulder, whatever, it's all going to be resolved mechanically the same way. And from a perspective of kind of system elegance and system, like, sense-making, and from the perspective of a game designer trying to design a new thing that has a knockdown mechanic, I can definitely see how this would be seen as an advantage. But in some ways, in terms of at-the-table play, the challenges created by the different mechanics that go with different monsters don't really pose that much of a problem, right? They're actually not that big a deal because you're only ever really going to be dealing with one of them at a time. And so it's actually just kind of convenient if the Death Dog has this knockdown attack, it helps to just have like a little couple of sentences devoted to a particular die roll you make in the Death Dog entry, which presumably you'll have in front of you at the table, rather than, you know, looking and seeing that the Death Dog has improved Bull Rush, but then you have to go back to the player's handbook and remind yourself what a Bull Rush is and what improving it does. I don't know if Death Dogs in 3rd have improved Bull Rush, but you know what I mean. So anyway, Death Dogs are pretty cool. They live in kind of deserts and other arid environments, which makes me, together with their like tall pointed ears, sort of makes me think of Anubis, the Egyptian god of the underworld, and how, of course, Anubis actually has the head of a jackal rather than a dog, but, you know, with similar ears. And I wonder if that artistic decision was intentional on the part of the artist here, old Russ Nicholson. He certainly has created a very kind of moody and sinister scene for the Death Dog to appear in, right? This dark night with the moon appearing behind one of the Death Dog's heads as it sort of looks around itself alertly, definitely giving you this idea about, you know, sort of like it's a hunter. I mean, this is going to tie in again to the idea of, you know, all the symbolic resonances around dogs, which I have previously discussed in our special episode about devil dogs. Next, we have the Death Knight. Now, the Death Knight was created by Charles Stross, and it is the same Charles Stross who went on to fame as a novelist, and perhaps best known for the Laundry series of novels, which are about a modern intelligence agency fighting against, the Cthulhu mythos, but with all the, like, bureaucracy and complexity of an actual intelligence agency rather than a bunch of glamorous James Bond or Delta Green stuff. Death Knights are a pretty classic concept. They are something that's very much gone on to sort of become part of the D&D, whatever they call it, brand identity, right? That's what you think of as classic D&D monsters. And that may partly be because the like 80s boom of, or maybe 90s as well, boom of Dungeons and Dragons novels included a lot of writing about what's-his-face. Lord Soth, who I believe was a Death Knight, wasn't he? Certainly when I visualize a Death Knight, I'm pretty sure that the figure I'm seeing, the kind of like the armored figure with like a, had like a veil, didn't it? And then the red eyes glowing out from inside, that's Lord Soth. Maybe it was the visor of his helmet rather than a veil. I don't really remember, but certainly, so it's definitely an iconic D&D monster, and conceptually it's really strong, right? These are these 12 paladins who betrayed their oaths and were therefore cursed to become undead. It strikes me that the gods or whoever, maybe they sold their soul to devils and became undead. That almost would be better, because if they were cursed to become undead, then okay, that's rough on them. Like, lots of people don't like being undead, I guess, but also turning loose 12 effectively supervillains on the world doesn't seem, you know, that seems like a lot of collateral damage to teach these 12 false paladins a particular moral lesson. I can't decide whether I like the idea better that being a Death Knight is just what happens to particularly egregious breakers of their paladin oaths, or whether it's like these 12 dudes, right? There's like the Knights of the Round Table all collectively betrayed the gods in order to do whatever it was, and wound up becoming Death Knights. They're sort of ring wraiths, really, aren't they? Like, again, the idea that they have these terrible powers, but that also it's sort of a curse. And they have big, black, sinister steeds, because they can ride around on nightmares. They can bring in demons as backup if they need it. They have some magical powers. They got magical swords. I mean, they are really full-service bad guys. It's interesting to me to see the inflation of hit points and damage that generally kind of have gone on in later editions. The Death Knight would, I'd expect the Death Knight on average to have something in the range of like 50 to 80 hit points, right? They have 9 hit dice, but their hit die is a d10. So I think that on average that is that 54, 55 hit points, something like that. It's not super amazing, right? Like, there are stock human combatant NPCs in 5th edition who have that many hit points. And I think this is probably just down to the more limited range of high damage options for player characters that don't have to beat the target's AC. But I don't know. That's just speculation. However, I mean, not that you're going to be facing one of them all by themselves. I assume that, you know, I mean, they got the magic horse, they got the sword, they can call in devils, and presumably each of these things rides at the head of some kind of legion of the undead. So either you've had to sneak through the camp and, you know, get into his black pavilion to strike him down, or you've had to slay your way through all these, you know, zombies and ghasts and whatever, and now finally you're up on top of him all bleeding and battered, and he rises from his throne and unsheathes a sword that fills the night with malevolent whispers, and, you know, then it's on. I don't know what to say about Death Knights, other than that they're pretty great. I mean, they're basically like a blasphemous undead version of the Paladin. Everybody's got a motive to hate them. They provide your magical undead types with much-needed muscle. You know, you can certainly see them kind of like acting as bodyguards to a lich or whatever. And they're kind of tragic figures, which takes a stock baddie and gives it, like, just enough pathos that there's a little more emotional richness to the process of bashing it to death with your Mace of Disruption. It just kind of becomes bashing things to death with your Mace of Disruption for grown-ups, when there's, like, this little bit of tragic backstory, but not the level of tragic backstory that kind of would invalidate the idea of bashing the thing to death with your Mace of Disruption. It just adds a little texture without subverting the point of having a big fight with a supervillain. Death Knights are pretty good. And I think it's interesting, you know, you can look at the Fiend Folio, I mean, and to some extent the Monster Manual, but even more so the Fiend Folio, and see that some of the things in it have kind of gone on to become iconic parts of Dungeons & Dragons, or at least have persisted through every iteration of Dungeons & Dragons in a way that, you know, not everything has. And I mention this particularly in the context of the Death Knight because it's a Charles Stross creation, and a lot of the Stross monsters have gone on to become core D&D creatures without ever really, like, spilling out very much beyond the bounds of the game in the way that, say, a Mimic has. So, I mean, we'll see this as we go on. The Giths are a Stross thing, and so are the Slod. So, they've all turned out to have legs, but they're all also still kind of within the bounds of a D&D creature. Except maybe the Death Knight, which is a big part of D&D, but also much more broadly relatable to a sort of core fantasy concept rather than something that's specifically part of the D&D IP. So yeah, an interesting monster and one that's had a persistent effect on the game and its sort of implied setting. All right, that's about all the time that we have for this week. Don't forget to vote in the Monster Man contest, and please join me next time when we're going to talk about demons, devils, and a little stone-eating blob on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the Deities and Demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.